Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight is a particular honor for me because, let's face it, my presence on this stage is pretty unlikely. My father was a foreign student, born and raised in a small village in Kenya. He grew up herding goats, went to school in a tin roof shack. His father, my grandfather, was a cook.
Welcome to Current Events with Patrick Cook. I'm your host, Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas, as I do every Sunday at 4 p.m. Central Time, 5 o'clock Eastern. We are the number one resource for small business and nonprofits. To learn how you can showcase your business or nonprofit, go to our website at TaylorMade101.com. That's T-A-I. LORMADE101.com and click on affiliates for details. Today we have a very special guest, the Esquire Abby Phelps is with us, also known as the Motor City Maharani. Esquire Abby is a nationally respected empowerment educational orator and training specialist that has presented at over 380 public venues in Michigan and throughout the country for over 20 years, and she is a relationship counselor. She created and founded the Parent University Initiative, Reviving the Village Initiative, the Season for Change School Fitness Program, Parents Taking the Lead Collaboration, and the list goes on. She has also served on Detroit Public Schools District Planning Team in 2002, Dr. Burnley Superintendent, Governor Calhoun's Transition Team for Public Education, the Detroit Parent Advisory Council, Area F School Executive Board, Southeastern Village Board of Detroit, Southeast Parent Alliance as the legal counsel, and a member of the Legal Aid Defenders Association Advisory Board. She has 17 years of outstanding talk radio experience and currently hosts three highly successful radio shows over the Blog Talk Radio Network. The Esquire Strikes Back at 3:30 p.m. on Fridays. Exhale, The Ultimate Experience, 6 o'clock on Saturdays. And Manna on High at 10 a.m. on Sundays. She is also highly in demand as a special guest on other popular shows. And to her immense resume, she now is nominated as a National Public Relations Spokesperson for this year's National Prayer Day, scheduled for May 5th. We are so excited to have Abby with us today. So sound the alarm. Get on Facebook, Twitter. Send out emails and text messages. Call your friends and families and tell them to tune in right now to Current Events with Patrick Cook. And so to join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. And for those of you that are listening via Blog Talk Radio, leave your comments. Click the follow button or follow me on Twitter at TaylorMade101. But first, let's take a look at our current events. Now, we're excited to be back after taking a couple of weeks off. Since that time, a lot has taken place. Apparently, we have started a third war. I stand corrected. Maybe I shouldn't call it a war. But the latest from the Washington Post coming out of Libya is as follows. Libya's rebel military struggled Saturday to explain an apparent rift within its highest ranks while acknowledging its soldiers' role in a mistaken NATO bomb of rebel columns in the night before. Now, the strike, which killed 13 rebels and injured 7, illustrated the hazards of conducting an aerial bombing campaign against a fluid and fast-moving front line. Several cars and an ambulance were also incinerated, and opposition leaders said rebels may have been responsible for the bombing because they have fired their guns into the air in celebration. It was a terrible mistake, and we apologize, and we will not let it happen again, said Abdul. So first, it was Muammar Gaddafi killing his own people. Now it looks like the people are killing their own people. At any rate, in my humble opinion, it is yet another distraction from the domestic issues here in the good old U.S. of A. Now, speaking of our challenging domestic issues, it was reported this week that the unemployment rate fell to a two-year low of 8.8% in March, and companies added workers at the fastest two-month pace since before the recession began. Now, the Labor Department says that the economy added 216,000 new jobs last month, offsetting layoffs of local government. Now, factory, retailers, education, healthcare, and an array of professional and financial services expanded their payrolls. Private employers, the backbone of the economy, drove nearly all of the gains. They added 230,000 jobs last month, on top of the 240,000 in February. Now, it was the first time private hiring topped 200K in back-to-back months since 2006, more than a year before the recession started. Now, the unemployment rate dipped from 8.9% in February to 8.8% in March. The rate has fallen a full percentage point over the last 4 months, the sharpest drop since 1983. Okay, for those of you that are not paying attention, let me tell you where things are going. There is a big push to draw down the local, state, and federal jobs. Let me say this again. There is a big push to draw down the local, state, and federal jobs. If you pay close attention, more and more government types of jobs will begin to dwindle, and more private jobs will begin to pick up slightly. Now, whether this is a good thing, this still remains to be seen. In fact, to illustrate the point, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal by Stephen Moore said that if you want to understand better why so many states from New York to Wisconsin to California are teetering on the brink of bankruptcy, consider this depressing statistic. Today in America, there are nearly twice as many people working for the government, 22.5 million, than in all manufacturing, 11.5 million. This is an almost exact reversal of the situation in 1960, when there were 15 million workers in manufacturing and 8.7 million collecting a paycheck from the government. It gets worse. More Americans work for the government than work in construction, farming, fishing, forestry, manufacturing, mining, and utilities combined. We have moved decisively from a nation of makers to a nation of takers. Nearly half of the $2.2 trillion cost of state and local governments is the $1 trillion a year tab for paying benefits of state and local employees. Is it any wonder that so many states and cities cannot pay their bills? Stephen Moore goes to say that in every state in America today, except for two, Indiana and Wisconsin, has more government workers on the payroll than people manufacturing industry goods. Consider California, which has the highest budget deficit in the history of the states. The not-so-golden state now has an incredible 2.4 million government employees, twice as many as people that work in manufacturing. New Jersey has just under 2.5 as many government employees as manufacturers. Florida's ratio is more than 3-1, so is New York's. Even Michigan, at one time the auto capital of the world, and Pennsylvania, once the steel capital, have more government bureaucrats than people making things. The leaders in government hiring are Wyoming and New Mexico, which have hired more than six government workers for every manufacturing worker. Now, it is certainly true that many states have not typically been home to traditional manufacturing operations. Iowa and Nebraska are farm states, for example. But in those states, there are at least five times more government workers than farmers. West Virginia is the mining capital of the world, yet it has at least three times more government workers than miners. New York is the financial capital of the world, at least for now. The sector employs roughly 670,000 New Yorkers. That's less than half of the state's 1.48 million government employees. So as you can see, this is a big push in layoffs is towards government employees. So as you see the dwindling of these jobs being, as they dissipate, notice they're going to be more government-related jobs. And that means a lot more is yet to come. But what puzzles me more than anything is that they are laying off so many teachers. Now, the president talked about in his State of the Union, when the future. Recall in the State of the Union, he talked about that. He also mentioned race to the top. However, since that time, we as a nation have laid off more teachers and took away their collective bargaining rights. Moreover, recall an Ohio mother of two was sentenced to 10 days in jail and placed on 3 years probation after sending her kids to school districts in which they did not live? What about the rate of tuition in college these days? I'm not sure if you heard about this, but that was the Huffington Post shined a light on Representative Denny Regberg. He's a Republican from Montana who chairs the House Appropriations Subcommittee on Labor, Health, and Human Services and Education that deals with the program. He has examined whether there are always to tie the grants to achievement or graduation rates. In a radio interview on Friday, he compared Pell Grants to welfare and decided that the fact that students who receive them don't have any sort of graduation requirement and could go straight from the education grants to food stamps. So you can go to college on Pell Grants. Maybe I should not be telling anybody this because it's turning out to be welfare of the 21st century, said Regberg in an interview on Blog Talk Radio. Now, the good book says, for where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. So it makes you wonder why we are not spending money in our education system. When we return, I would love to hear from you. So I'm going to open up the phone lines. So to join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. Be back in a moment. Current Events with Patrick Cook is joining the fight with First Lady Michelle Obama to help feed hungry children and stop childhood obesity. During the school year, many children receive free and reduced price breakfast and lunch as a result of the school breakfast and national school lunch programs. However, when the last bell sounds, marking the end of the school year, for many, it marks the beginning of hunger that will plague them throughout the summer. Here at Current Events, we're going to fill that nutrition gap and make sure children can get the nutritious meals they need. To learn how you can help with this worthy cause, go to TaylorMade101.com and click on Hunger Free. That's TaylorMade101.com and click on Hunger Free.
Cook Enterprises have joined forces with Google Inc. and Amazon.com. With this new partnership, our company, TaylorMade Training and Consulting, Current Events, and Ask Jima can now offer you the best deals 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Whether you're looking for a discounted book for your book club or a very special gift for a friend, family member, or loved one, TaylorMade's Marketplace is where you should go first. Visit our website at TaylorMade101.com and click on Marketplace to get the best deals today.
Okay, welcome back to Current Events with Patrick Cook. before we take some calls, I'd like my co-host, Jima, to weigh in on a few things. Now, I understand the financial position we have found ourselves in this country, but Jima, why should we cut teachers' jobs?
Well, I don't think we should be cutting teachers' jobs, and good afternoon to you and to the listeners. I don't think we should be cutting teachers' jobs primarily because it is the teachers that spend the majority of time with our children outside of those of us that are at home. So when we're talking about, and I think it's just a big, and listening to you earlier with your reflections, the moments of reflections around a distraction and what's going on, this has just been one major distraction, even talking about the size of state government, has just been one major distraction as to what's really happening. So I don't think we should be cutting teacher salaries, but, you know, it just seems as though cutting teachers' positions, not just their salaries, but we're talking about putting 30 kids in a class with one teacher because we're getting rid of teachers, we're getting rid of paraprofessionals, and yet I don't see anything happening a lot of times in the administrative areas, but a lot happening with those people that do the grunt work, those people that are on the front lines. But unfortunately, that's usually how it happens. But I don't think it's something we ought to really do as a nation because we're really setting ourselves up for failure.
Okay. Well, I'm going to go to our phone lines right now. We have a caller, last four, 7781. Welcome to Current Events with Patrick Cook. Do you have a comment or a question?
Yes. My name is Larry Johnson. Thanks again for taking my call.
Welcome, Larry.
Thank you, sir. I kind of wanted to go to the point you made about, you know, the federal government having most of the jobs compared to private or corporate business. And I'm a little bit torn between, you know, protectionism in America because it really doesn't exist except for teachers' unions and federal employees or work that only American citizens can do. And so I think to a certain extent that the teachers' union and the way teachers are compensated and paid and those kind of things, it needs some work around it. But I'm actually a little bit for those protected jobs because a lot of jobs in America from the private or corporate business sector are being sent overseas without any protection. So Americans saying IT doesn't have any unions anymore, so they can send a job overseas to get someone else to work on it in these other countries in a race to the bottom. So I think that, you know, we should protect teachers' unions and we should protect federal employees because there's really nowhere left for an American citizen to work to know they're going to have a job the next day. So what are your thoughts? I mean, what are some other ways outside of those entities that, you know, you think America can provide protectionism but at the same time to provide innovation? Because, I mean, I'll let you talk in a second, but it used to be where innovation came from the federal government. The microwave, the internet, and even GPS, those were based on federal programs. So, but now it's more or less on the public sector providing the innovation, the Googles and the Microsofts. But again, you know, going back to our question, you know, what are ways that you think that America can provide protectionism for American citizens outside of unions and those kind of things?
So to address your question, I see that I see a problem in the shift from the government jobs to the private sector, only because the private sector normally, although they are concerned about innovation and technology and moving, they're also concerned about their books. And so the basic mantra of capitalism is based on labor. And so if you can get cheap labor at anywhere you can, that's where they're going to shift the workers. So the workers will be shifted in that direction. So, for example, if you have this outflux of jobs from the government, they're going to make themselves available to the private industry, and then private industry start to try to hire these employees. And then all of a sudden, when they reach their maximum as far as salaries are concerned, and they can't, you know, reap those quarters after quarters after quarters, then they look outside of the United States to hire cheaper labor. So now we don't have government jobs, and now we don't have private sector jobs. So it puts us in a real unique position because we don't have any tax dollars going into the government. So it's really It's a really interesting situation that we're in now as we begin to lay off the government workers and move towards the private sector. But over time, you will find that the private sector is going to be concerned about their bottom line. And so the bottom line is based on labor. And, you know, that's the basic foundation of capitalism. So it's a very unique position that we're in. So, Jim, I want to talk a little bit more about this particular situation with respect to jobs, and specifically the teachers' jobs. And right now, the president talked about winning the future. I talked about it in my opening segment, and he said, but we're cutting programs that gives young men and women supplemental education opportunities, too. So it's not, I mean, as you said, they're cutting positions, but they're also cutting the funding that goes into these systems. And so what kind of impact do you think this will have on our society? So, Jim, I can't hear you.
I'm sorry. I've spent the last 16 years working in state government, working in juvenile justice, and I can tell you that it's going to have a great impact on systems. By that I mean when you begin to take away from environments that produce learning and something structured, you leave a vast majority of our population with nothing to do. What generally happens when people have nothing to do? They get into trouble. So where you're going to see growth in an industry will probably be in our correctional penal system, because we're not going to have enough space to house the ones coming in, because if you're taking away after school activities and you're not feeding kids are going to start stealing because they're hungry. You're going to have, they're taking away so many of the things that sustain us that once those things are no longer there, then people do what they have to do to survive. And so the impact is going to be great on our systems, because our kids, families, it's just going to be such an increase in crime. Our homes are going to not maintain the values that we purchased them at. It's going to be phenomenal, the amount of impact it's going to have on our system.
So tell our listeners a little bit about your background. You mentioned the 15 years. Tell them, what did you used to do, or what's your expertise in the area?
I started in 1992 working in juvenile justice, working in an institution for the state of Missouri. And in that, I ran facilities for juvenile offenders that had been adjudicated. And by that, I mean they had been found guilty of a crime and had been sentenced to the Division of Youth Services. In that, there was places in which they could go. They were, for all practical purposes, they were in jail. They couldn't go home or whatever, anything like that. They were sentenced to us for a significant period of time based on the crime in which they committed. So I worked extensively on the inside of juvenile justice when kids have committed a crime and they have to go away, as well as the community advocate support, where when those programs go away, you see an increase in crime. So an example, in the early 1990s, President Clinton instituted a juvenile crime bill, and with it there was attached a whole bunch of money where the goal was to do more on the front end, to have true preventive programs available to juveniles. So you saw a decrease in juvenile crime, you saw a decrease in needing of placements, because kids were being cared for on the front end of even getting in trouble, so there wasn't a need for them to come into the system. Well, once the money ran out, you saw a spike. You saw an increase in juvenile crime going back up again. Well, why is that? Because you took away the money. You took away the programs, and you took away the access and the resources. And some things can work on their own, but a lot of them do need some subsidy from the government to make it work and to make it be effective. There's one thing to have a program. There's nothing to have a program that's effective, that's teaching young men and young women how to in this society in which we're living in now. And so with those years of experience, I see the trend that when we begin to take away that money from those community service programs, those Head Starts, you know, we know we live in an age now where we have to get kids younger in terms of trying to be an influence in them. We can't wait till they get to high school. We really have to start in elementary school now, seeing some of the things we're seeing in the news with six-year-olds bringing candy to school and it got marijuana in it. I mean, brownies or whatever they brought to school. There's so many different things, so we know we have to start earlier. But if we take away those programs, and we take away the funding for those effective programs, then we're going to see an increase on the backside of that, which is more kids being institutionalized.
Okay. We're going to go to the phone lines again. We have a caller, our last four is 7036. Caller, you're on Current Events with Patrick Cook. You have a comment or a question?
Yes, hello? I'm sorry, yes. I hear a lot of background noise. I actually have a comment. And it's actually a bold comment, but I wanted to speak to the point that we were talking, where you all were talking about different teachers being laid off and a lot of their jobs being cut. And I think it goes back to, if you look at it from a different perspective, I think a lot of people today are getting in the field of education for the wrong reasons, because I know a lot of people that are, where the quality of teaching has totally diminished. It's totally diminished. And if you look at it from a different perspective, I would hope that with the teachers' jobs getting cut, that it goes back to people getting in that field for, with, you know, just for quality purposes and really caring about the children. Because I think if you look at the different fields of education, some people, or I should say a lot of people, seem to get in it for the wrong reason now, and so you don't get quality teachers out there. And so I hope this will weed out some of the teachers that aren't of good quality, because they're, you know, our children are what we have for the future, and if you don't have a good quality teacher, then it defeats the purpose of trying to implement programs that are going to help the children. So I think it, in a weird kind of way, it doesn't, I'm all for the government cutting teachers' jobs within reason, because hopefully it'll be a wake-up call and weed out the ones that don't care about the students, where they're making it just a job.
Okay, interesting point, Carl. I would like to ask you a follow-up question. So the quality, just, let's say, for example, the quality goes up with respect to the teachers being into the system. But, you know, and there are studies out there to show the teacher-to-student ratio, as it goes up, the quality of the education goes down. So although you have a good quality education teacher in the classroom, when they begin to have 30 and 35 and 40 students in the classroom, do you think that's kind of disruptive?
Absolutely. I think it's absolutely disruptive. But I think that quantity-wise, yes, it is going to be disruptive. But I think you have to learn how to adjust. Just because, and I mean, I'm not in a situation where I'm a teacher, but I have been, when I do the job and the career, the path that I have, I'm going to do it all for quality. And I'm given stuff, and I have to adjust sometimes that isn't always comfortable. And so I think quality and quantity in this case really has nothing to do with it, because if you are a quality teacher and you really care about the well-being of your students, then you learn to adjust and you try to make best with what you have. I mean, it's easier said than done, I do believe, when you're actually in that situation, but I mean, you have to realize what the bigger goal is at the end of the day. You're training and molding lives and minds that are going to be forever impacted that by how you treat them and by what you teach them. I grew up in a school where we had a lot of students in our classroom, but I significantly remember the teachers that stuck with us. You could tell the difference between a teacher that cared versus the teacher that was just collecting a check and the teacher that made it work no matter what. So I think quantity, unfortunately, does not have anything to do. If you're a good teacher and you care about the students, you make it work with what you have.
Awesome. Thank you for your call.
Absolutely. Bye-bye.
So, Jim, I want to ask, pose another question along the same lines. I mean, the caller just talked about quality and the fact that, you know, it will weed out certain teachers and the ones that want to be there are probably going to give you a better quality. But I want to know, do you think, as a society, do you think we value education? And I pose that question simply because of the controversy at Rutgers University around the disparity in speaking fees between Snooki and Toni Morrison. I know there's anything wrong with this picture, but I mean, it kind of strike me as odd that they were willing to pay, the university was willing to pay Snooki more in compensation than they were Toni Morrison when she had all these accolades and awards, and really Snooki didn't have anything really to offer than other than her fame. So, I mean, are we in a society of showmanship as opposed to scholarship now?
What was that? Are we in a society of, what was that first part?
Of showmanship rather than scholarship.
I'm going to say on a small scale, yes, I think we are. I don't necessarily know if that we don't value education. I don't think we see the value in education. By that, I mean we have become a nation of right now. We have become a nation of quick and fast and in a hurry. And so anything that takes time, we don't really want to invest a whole lot in it. Prime example, when we're talking about, as the president stated, you know, winning the future and trying to move us forward, we're not going to win the future today. We're not even going to win the future tomorrow. It's going to be a couple tomorrows before we begin to win the future. But we want to see winning the future right now, but we don't want to put in the work that it takes to win the future. And so because of that, we're ready to cut off anything that's not going to give us a quick fix today. And in doing so, we really end up selling ourselves short and endangering our children in the long run. So do we value it? I think some of us value education. I think as a nation in our totality, we don't get that valuing education means, as the caller was saying, we do want the best teachers in the classroom. We do want the best mentors out there mentoring our children. We do want the best of the best, but to get the best, you have to prepare the best. So we're not going to get better teachers because we're not preparing better teachers. We're not training better teachers. So the teachers that we have that's coming into the field, you know, have been slighted somewhat in terms of what we've been able to provide them. Our education system has taken a nosedive over the last 10 years. So how the foundation of who we are as a country is shattered right now. It's a little shaky because some of the things that we once believed in that we held near and dear, we no longer hold near and dear. I don't think we hold teachers at a, you know, where they can go out and do whatever they want to do, but I think for so long we missed, assessed what was needed. And so we kept people in positions because they had been there, as opposed to having the right person in the position.
Yeah, and I go back to my original point early on when I said that for where your treasure is, there will your heart be also, quoting the good book. And because I'm not seeing the money go in that direction, is really where I'm really equating the value system, our value system. When I see dollars being taken away from education, when I see Rutgers University saying that we're going to pay Snooki more than you're going to pay Toni Morrison, you know, when the quality of compensation towards teachers, you know, again, for where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. I know we have a lot of good rhetoric around our education system, but I just don't see the money being invested into our system.
And I would have to say, along with that, I'm not even sure if we know where our treasure is. I think it's all over the place. We haven't agreed upon, as a country, as a nation, where is our treasure? What is it that we really believe in today? And how do we show that we believe in that thing? If we truly believe in education, then what is it going to look like? If we truly believe in rebuilding our communities, and if we truly believe in rebuilding our economy, what does it look like? You know, and who decides for us what that looks like? And one other thing you talked about earlier when we were talking about the president, I think one thing that we did, we as a country, we allowed, because when you look at these different states, you're talking about Ohio and Wisconsin and Indiana and Florida and all these places that have all these things going on around the unions and collective bargaining and all that. What we did as simple voters is that we allowed a few people to make what our local issues were not as important as a national issue. And so because we did that, we now are stuck with some of these people that were elected. And so we voted not in our best interest, but we voted in the interest of someone else, and now we are reaping what we sown, basically. So when you're looking at the totality of what we have to deal with, we have to look at, is it that collective bargaining is a bad thing? And whoever said that it was? When you look at the fact that we have a five-day work week and a 40-hour work week, those things came from collective bargaining. When you look at, you know, certain jobs where you have to get 2 15-minute breaks a day and at least a half hour for lunch, those things came from collective bargaining. So a lot of what we take for granted, and, you know, it's all due to collective bargaining, and somewhere along the line we've forgotten that, and we want to make that be the villain, and it's not. Mm-hmm. We enjoy a lot from that.
Wonderful. Okay, we're gonna move into the next half of the show here. When we return, our very special guest, the Esquire Abby, will be joining us. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. Current Events with Patrick Cook is joining the fight with First Lady Michelle Obama to help feed hungry children and stop childhood obesity. During the school year, many children receive free and reduced-price breakfast and lunch as a result of the school breakfast and national school lunch programs. However, when the last bell sounds, marking the end of the school year, for many, it marks the beginning of hunger that will plague them throughout the summer. Here at Current Events, we're going to fill that nutrition gap and make sure children can get the nutritious meals they need. To learn how you can help with this worthy cause, go to TaylorMade101.com and click on Hunger Free. That's TaylorMade101.com and click on Hunger Free.
Cook Enterprises have joined forces with Google Inc. and Amazon.com. With this new partnership, our company, TaylorMade Training and Consulting, Current Events, and Ask Jima can now offer you the best deals 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Whether you're looking for a discounted book for your book club or a very special gift for a friend, family member, or loved one, TaylorMade's Marketplace is where you should go first. Visit our website at TaylorMade101.com and click on Marketplace to get the best deals today.
Welcome back to Current Events with Patrick Cook. Today, our very special guest is the Esquire Abby Phelps, the Modi City Maharani. Esquire Abby is a nationally respected empowerment educational orator and training specialist that has presented at over 380 public venues in Michigan and throughout the country for over 20 years. Welcome to the show, Abby.
Hey, thank you so much, Mr. Cook, and hello, listening audience. As Marvin Gaye would say in the old adage, let's get it on.
All right. So tell us a little bit about you and your work.
Oh, yes. I started off in the public school sector 23 years ago, to be exact. My daughter was in the early childhood program known as Project Head Start. During that time, the federal government was pouring money into the states, and the states were pouring money into the districts, and the districts were pouring money into the local schools to fund this very needful and very instructive program that taught children early on how to adapt to other social environments outside of the home. And it also had a very strong and stringent component with parental involvement, which drew me in because I was in college during the time. And as a single parent, I faced the same challenges as other parents. But I believe that education didn't start when my child went to the local school. Education started in my household. I had to lay the foundational mechanisms and just hold the teachers accountable to the secondary level of teaching, because I knew as a parent that I was my child's first and foremost teacher. And so after getting exposed to the early childhood learning environment, I went back and got trained with the High Scope initiative, which taught the Montessori model infused with the new age technology of teaching, which taught children global education, respect, and cultural enhancement. And from there on, I began to understand the dynamics of how the local school operated, that there was a body of governance, there was a body that governed the curriculum, student support, professional development, then I learned that there was a macrostructure that dealt with the district as a whole. So as I began to progress and be trained, you know, it led me to just become a part of the local school. And I realized that I could be a bigger part of the solution as opposed to being a greater part of the problem. And I heard the parents say earlier, Mr. Cook and listening audience, about what the teacher should do, the teacher should do. Yes, they should do, but let me tell you something. We're talking about now the dynamics of things, the paradigms have shifted. We're talking about 35 to 40 students in a classroom, and with the latest legislation being passed in this state of Michigan, perhaps up to 60 students in one classroom with one instructor. Now, you're talking about an instructor that's lost $250 per paycheck. Now, you calculate the math and do the science, Mr. Cook and listening audience. That's $500 a month this teacher is losing. Besides that, calculate 40% for medical coverage, for dental coverage, out-of-pocket costs for vision care. So you're talking about an educator that's supposed to be inspired and take on this existential load, knowing that they've taken a severe salary cut as well as an unperpendicular level of other fiscal responsibilities that was once covered? Don't think so. It has to be a collective and a collaborative effort to reform, reshape, and reanalyze and restructure the current public school sector and the school sector in general. So that's where my involvement got in, Mr. Cook. And I started from the primary level, and I just worked my way up because I knew that I had to become an intricate part of the changeover process to improve the overall structure of the educational system.
So, Esquire Abbey, you talked about Project Head Start and parental involvement several decades ago, and you talked about the fact that how it was an integral part of our society. I really don't see that today, that Head Start program, especially funded as it was 30 years ago. So can you compare and contrast then, meaning you had that support infrastructure in place, you had the Head Start, to now when there's not that much, and then the quality of our kids?
Yes. Oh, definitely, because I'm definitely an advocate for early childhood education, for the education system indeed. Well, under the Bush administration, both junior and senior, they definitely did their damaging perimeters to the early childhood program, literally calling a all-day babysitting service. And so as a result of Bush Jr., he literally obliterated the Head Start program. We have a very scant percentage, I think only about 13% of the preschool programs pre-existent within our state. They lost funding. They lost the capacity of special government funds because most of the centers were funded by Title I funding, which is the funding that is allocated for aiding disadvantaged children so that they can achieve their academic goals. And they literally obliterated the funding. So we've seen a great diminishing in that program, literally non-existent. We only have a few preschools, and most of them are operated under the municipalities, not with the local school districts. There's literally no funding there. And the sad part is that parents, because of the legislation with the Department of Human Services requiring them to either participate in the Work First program, which is supposed to teach them job readiness skills and to secure them with employment, literally 29% of the parents that participated even got jobs. The other, 71% are yet remaining jobless. They literally have nothing intact. So because of those things, that's what definitely affected our level of parent involvement, all these unrealistic expectations on parents. And when the federal government gave the power of the state the overall welfare program, as so many refer to it as being, that's when we really seen how the cruelty of the system was in place. It took the parents out of the school, demanded that they perform slave labor, be trained for jobs that they know they're not going to even be employment ready for, only as a way of manipulating, of monopolizing upon those who are less fortunate than others.
Okay, so you mentioned a little bit about the Montessori model, and I'm very familiar with that. In fact, my son attends a Montessori academy, and there's a big push towards charter schools. And so, which is a different dynamic than what I'm used to or grew up in. In fact, with the public school system was really all we had. But now there's this big push for charter schools. So, can you talk a little bit about, what's your opinion about the charter schools as opposed to the normal public schools?
Well, that is a great comparison and a great advantage that public schools have over charter schools. And the first thing is we look at teacher quality and accountability and credibility. Under the guidelines for the local districts throughout the state of Michigan and even throughout the country, teachers must be certified and highly qualified, which indicates to the fact that they must possess a master's degree or better and go back for extra-essential training in language arts and literacy. Now, the charter schools are not mandating that most of their educators, at least from the precarities of what we got, 41% of them were not even educators. They were professional people who had, you know, had certifications but not an education. They did not have the criteria of even understanding the dynamics, the macro or the micro dynamics of the education system. They had no knowledge of education, period. But because the school is chartered, is under a company or a privatized business association, the hierarchies take control of the children's educational destiny. Here with the public school sector, we have a flow chart. We have a district superintendent who is the chief operating officer of the district. And the charter school administration, you have CEOs, corporate managers, who, once again, have no knowledge of educational criteria. They have no knowledge of curriculum. They have no knowledge of professional development. They don't understand the six developmental pathways of learning. They don't understand the importance of community and parent involvement. These people are literally, you know, just novices that are attempting to be professionals in which they're not. The public school sector demands under the Title I law, 103.382, section 1118, that parental involvement must be current and that an official organization of record must be instilled within each school before they can receive any level of funding, and that level of participation must be documented. Under the charter school administration, no such documentations. Children can literally be dropped off by their parents. Every now and then, if needful and necessary, parents can come, but they have an option. Under the public school sector, there is no option. There must be an official body of accountability and participation. We look at the dynamics of the curriculum that's taught. Our curriculum, and I know in your state as well and across the country, we are required by that Department of Education of that state to do what's called perform the benchmarks. The benchmarks are identification parameters of each area of curriculum that must be mastered. And along with that, the district pacing chart that shows the level that must be accommodated before any student can be successfully promoted to the next grade level. Does the charter school have this? No. It's an open door curriculum. Whatever that's needful and necessary that they feel should be taught is taught without any reflectiveness upon those core curriculum framework benchmarks, which are reflective of the U.S. Department of Education that says you must master these exit skills before being promoted. So literally, charter schools cannot even compare. They can't even compete with what's offered in the public school sector.
So Esquire Amber, let me play devil's advocate here for a second. Let's say hypothetically, sure, I was to say that my school, my child has been attending public school for the last 12 years, and he was a part of the test that they took last year, and it reported that the U.S. ranked 17th in science and 25th in math. And if and, you know, and there's been plenty of evidence to show that our school system lacks behind a lot of other nations around the world. And so these students are taught by teachers that you talked about that have these degrees. They have these professional development classes, but yet they're not producing results. But these charter schools, in many cases, you know, it hasn't been given the test of time, you know, in its totality. But the charter schools are producing results. What do you say to that?
Okay, first of all, we would look at the dynamics because each school's, you know, population is different.
Mm-hmm.
And to a population of the urban district, you know, we look at the concentration of societal issues that may be coexistent, that may, you know, be a catalyst in deterring certain levels of student progress. And we have to look at the dichotomy of that in comparison to what the charter school is doing. Then secondly, we have to look at the way in which teaching is being implemented. Because under the core curriculum framework, under the district's pacing chart. You know, each teacher is required to produce lesson plans that are reflective of those contents. And then we have to also look at the level in which the student may have some, you know, in-depth emotional issues. Oftentimes, and this is a terrible thing to say, but I have to say it as being an advocate of the public education sector. Sometimes when you are in overcrowded classrooms and you have 30 students, you multiply that by three. Each student has three different distinctive personalities. They're coming from households oftentimes that are plagued with a lot of sociological issues. You're looking at dealing with 90 different people in your classroom, and you're one person. By the time you get through with the behavioral modification of being the counselor, of being the referee, and sometimes being the coach, you've got to manipulate the time as being the secular parent or the surrogate parent. Then you've got to turn around and become the administrator within the classroom. There's not much time left to render instruction. So we have to look at the dichotomy of the issues in which that may have affected students' level of achievement. But any school, and even to our school, we have students that are definitely economically challenged. They come from single-parent households. Actually, about 82% of our students come from single-parent households in which the females are the dominating force in that household. But the thing is that you have to curb your curriculum and your methodology of instruction to students that are in that way. And one of the best ways to identify when students are not performing at an accurate rate, there has to be some communication. Again, this is where parental involvement comes into play. The teacher communicates, because every week a teacher is supposed to submit a progress report reflective of that student's performance within that classroom. This is a mandatory type of stipulation that allows the parent early on to know what's going on. And then with a follow-up procedure, if the progress is not upgraded, that parent is supposed to be called into the school. We have what we call, Mr. Cook, a multiple disciplinary task force student assessment team, or some of them call student support teams. And what we do is we look at the performance of the curricula as far as the student is concerned. Is it matching? Is it adamant to that grade level? We look at whether or not there may be some developmental delays or deficits. We look at whether or not the language, the pathology of the language may be required for some further extensive services from a TISLE, which is a speech therapist. We look at whether or not there need to be some psychological intervention. A lot of students, they may be performing at the norm, but they have some deep emotional psychological deficits. So we look at each child. You have to look at each child independent to see where their need is and why is there a lapse in their performance. So this, again, is what gives us the competitive edge in this public school sector. And sometimes students may be in a classroom where they're not accommodated because they have special needs, and this is when we refer them over to the other psychological student support services, which allows them to have placement into a classroom environment where they can get to the level where they need to be, and if they continue to progress sooner or later down the line, we're through the unilateral tracking system that the public school sector utilizes from the Department of Student Specialized Services, we may be able to mainstream them back into the intermediate learning environment.
You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. Today, our very special guest is the Esquire Abbey Phelps, the Motor City Maharani. Esquire Abbey is a nationally respected empowerment educational orator and training specialist that has presented at over 380 public venues in Michigan and throughout the country for over 20 years. So, Esquire Abbey, it's obviously that you are very passionate about this subject. So what inspired you to get in this line of work?
My biggest inspiration, again, was back in early childhood. And I've seen the perimeters in which there were so many societal and economic challenges within the span of our city, which in the span of our community. And I decided to become a bigger part of the solution as opposed to a greater part of the problem. I knew that the changeover process and the, you know, accountability of the educational pursuits of my child wasn't just geared toward my child's teacher. I am the first teacher that my child is exposed to why. No one knows my child better than I why. I carried my child 9 months in my womb. My child was close to my heart. Now that my child is birthed, she's heavy on my mind. So I have that connectivity piece with her, and I know that I had to lay down the foundations at home. And I saw the reason why a lot of students didn't have the competitive edge, because my daughter maintained a very high GPA level. I was a single parent. I was a struggling single parent. You know, I, you know, faced the odds and adversities, but at the same time, I did comparative analysis, and I found out that the students whose parents were involved, actively involved in their education, they scored higher on their benchmark tests. They had a better attitude and a better latitude toward learning, and I know that I wanted the best for my child, so I decided to just get involved and to, you know, exploit and utilize my talents to help build the school environment as opposed to criticizing it. So this is the message that I give to parents. You know, there's a lot of things that you may not like about your child's school and you're finding fault with it. Why don't you go there and become a part of the changeover process? Because after all, parents are the mainstreaming establishment that gears the local schools to move forward. They're the best resources that the school has, because when the administrator comes in, and so many of them have taken intense pay cuts, the administrators or the principals don't have unions. They're literally working from year-to-year contract under their district. They have an immense load. They've got to manage a staff of 30 or more people. They've got to deal with budget. They've got to deal with deficit. They have to deal with, you know, managing curriculum and a whole lot of things. And then the instructors in the classroom are under all this duress of, you know, having their paychecks literally snatched from up under them, losing their benefits, and they're having overcrowded classrooms. They don't have much mind left. You look at the clerical. They're overwhelmed with a totally new technological system. So there's just a lot of parameters that are occurring there. And parents, you have a clear bird's eye view, because sometimes the $100 can be on that floor. Everybody walks past that $100. Why? Because they're so overwhelmed. You're the fresh blood. You're the fresh eyes that walks into that building and says, you know, there's $100 on this floor, and you can pick it up and then make the best use of it yet. So parental involvement is a key factor in any degree of a school's success and also of a district's success.
So is it fair to say that there are some barriers that prevent parents' parental involvement?
Yes, they are. And the first one, and we named earlier, Mr. Cook and listening audience, was the what they refer to as the welfare system. I don't like using welfare system. I'll just say the Department of Human Service System or the Family Independence Agency, as it's formerly known. They are putting these unrealistic requirements on parents in order to get their benefits and their food card allotments. They have to participate. If they don't have a job and they're not full-time in school, they have to participate in a work-first skills and preparations program, and that program is like 8 hours a day, four, sometimes 5 days a week. They don't care if the snow is up to knee-high, past your hips. You have to go, because if not, they will definitely sanction your benefits. You will lose your medical. Your child will lose their medical. You will lose your food stamp benefits. You will lose your grant. And so that pulled a lot of parental involvement, too, out of the schools, because parents, you choose the option. And I know I would do the same thing, too. Go to the school, get involved, and see what my child is doing, be an intricate part of the changeover process, or make sure that my family has food on the table, utilities, the meager, you know, establishments and associations of life. You're going to choose to make sure your family has the biological necessities intact. So that's
absolutely
the first way we lost. Isn't that something? The first thing. And another thing, too, Mr. Cook, and this is a little unpleasant, but oftentimes I have to lecture talking about this, substance abuse plays a key element in why we've lost a lot of our parents. And I'll go into details, and it's going to get a little graphic. It's a sad factor that many of our young ladies, because most of our households are headed by single parents that are under the age of 50, which you're young when you're under the age of 50. Isn't that a blessing?
Yes, it is.
And these, a lot of times, because they have so many societal issues and they have so many other things that's hanging upon them instead of going out and getting involved and finding out what resources are there to surpass them or to remedy the situation, they will utilize other measures of coping. And I look at the drugs, whether it's the crack cocaine or the marijuana or even the alcohol overindulgence, as a way of escaping the cruelty of what life has introduced to them. And as a result of that, you know, oftentimes they will feel like, hey, I don't want to be in the school. People know that I'm going to the drug house. They see me, you know, going in the morning. They see me when I get some money. They know where I'm going. Everybody talks in the community. And they see me at the liquor store before the store even gets open, you know, and everything. My children are not quite dressed the way the other kids. They're not maintained the way the other kids are. So I'm not going up to that school so they can judge me. And lo and behold, I have to be honest, being a professional, and I have to speak and tell the truth. Yes, a lot of us are very prejudiced and very cruel when people have problems. Instead of embracing that individual, charging it to their head and not to their heart, we become cruel, judgmental, and asinine. And the first thing we say, she don't care anything about her kids. I have found out that in 92% of the cases that have come to me, Mr. Cook and listening audience, even when parents have substance abuse issues and they may be negligent in other aspects of life, they love their children. They want the best for their children, but they're trapped in a cage where there seems to be no way out. And then lo and behold, if they finally decide to reach out when protective services gets involved and it becomes extensive, because after 9 consecutive absences with no excuse, then, you know, it steps up to the court system, the 36th District Court here in the state of Michigan, or to the Child Protective Services, and they may lose their children. Then they finally say, you know what, I've got to get some help. Then I have to write the referral for them to go into treatment, you know, and rehabilitation. And it becomes that desperate. But until then, they kind of like play it by ear. And that's another way that we've lost a lot of parents. And the third thing that I have to say is this: a lot of parents don't have stabilized residency. If you're living with someone and you don't have your own place, this is a new phase of definition of being homeless. You don't have a stable place of residency independently so of your own. A lot of times, a lot of women attempt to make, you know, a go with a child's father and living under very cruel, vindictive situations, and you know, it escalates to domestic or physical abuse. And for some reason, one term or another, she feels desperate. She has to move. The next thing you know, the child has to move. And then sometimes 2 weeks go by, and then this goes over to the attendance agent. The attendance agent turns it over to the court. But then we turn around and find that the parent resurfaces again and says, you know what, I had to move because, you know, my one significant other tried to kill me. Then we have to cancel the case out, do another whole inventory, and try to see how we can place that child back in school when it's not held accountable to the parent. So lack of true residency and homelessness is the third most primal factor.
Wow. Hi, Esquire. We're going to take a quick break, and then ask Jima, we're going to have you ask a few questions when we return. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. Current Events with Patrick Cook is joining the fight with First Lady Michelle Obama to help feed hungry children and stop childhood obesity. During the school year, many children receive free and reduced-price breakfast and lunch as a result of the school breakfast and national school lunch programs. However, when the last bell sounds, marking the end of the school year, for many, it marks the beginning of hunger that will plague them throughout the summer. Here at Current Events, we're going to fill that nutrition gap and make sure children can get the nutritious meals they need. To learn how you can help with this worthy cause, go to TaylorMade101.com and click on Hunger Free. That's TaylorMade101.com and click on Hunger Free.
Cook Enterprises have joined forces with Google Inc. and Amazon.com. With this new partnership, our company, TaylorMade Training and Consulting, Current Events, and Ask Jima can now offer you the best deals 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Whether you're looking for a discounted book for your book club or a very special gift for a friend, family member, or loved one, TaylorMade's Marketplace is where you should go first. Visit our website at TaylorMade101.com and click on Marketplace to get the best deals today.
Welcome back to Current Events with Patrick Cook. Today, our very special guest is the Esquire Abby Phelps. Abby is a nationally respected empowerment educational orator and training specialist that has presented at over 380 public venues in Michigan and throughout the country for over 20 years. And she is a relationship counselor. She created and founded the Parent University Initiative, Reviving the Village Initiative, the Season for Change School Fitness Program, and Parents Taking the Lead Collaboration, and the list goes on. Now, Jima, you wanted to ask a few questions, and we're going to also open up the phone lines for others to call in and ask Esquire Abby some questions. Go ahead, Jima.
I just had one question, Ms. Abby. I was reading an article in Essence magazine about the prosecutor there in Detroit that wants to jail parents for skipping out on parent-teacher conferences. What's your thoughts about that?
Well, you know something, I'm kind of in the midst of saying, and I'm just being exact, you know, I try to keep it real. I don't think that that's fair, because when you look at the challenges that some parents are having, it's literally saying to them, you do it my way or it's the highway. Again, because of so many things that are pulling parents in another direction. We're talking about the unrealistic demand of a workforce initiative, that parents 8 hours per day, whether they get a job or not, and if you don't get a job, you have to re-enroll into the program. But that takes a lot of time from parents. We're looking, a lot of parents have the substance abuse issues that I stated about earlier, and they're struggling against that addiction. Then the third thing, we looked at the homeless rate. You know, so many of them don't have stabilized places of residency. So I think that that particular judge needs to take into consideration all these external factors and then come up with a far better way of resolving this issue.
Yeah, I was just reading and listening to what she was having to say about it. It seems as though it's the last resort. That's not what happens first off, but just trying to get parents, as you were stating earlier, to be more active in their children's lives some kind of way,
yeah.
Figuring out how to do it, you know. And not wanting jail to be the answer, but if there, you know, if all else fails, the call, the whatever, you know, so many different avenues to try to do it, and they can't find it one time out of that school year to participate, you know, she's
right.
Just saying that we have to do something.
That's right. That's right. And you know something, lady, I agree with you, and I say with the judge again, to think of another alternative. And see, we learn to be creative at our school, because what we have is oftentimes parents are not able to come physically to the parent-teacher conference or to the PTA meetings. What we do is we actually have conference call parent meetings. If they sign up and say, put me in on the conference call, okay, then. I've had a conference call parent meeting with up to about 72 parents who normally may have never came to the physical building because of all the unrealistic demands that are being placed upon them, and some of them with the external issues that they're facing, that actually participate in these phone conferences. And it's very fruitful and very multiplicious, where they can get a better understanding of what's required of them, what their students are doing, and what they need to do to fuel the engine more. So local schools, I say, would have to learn to become more creative. And then another thing that we do too in our school is that we actually do networking outside of our meetings. Sometimes what we do is we'll proclaim a public venue. We'll meet here for coffee and donuts. The coffee and donuts are funded by TCF Bank, for example. And, you know, they give them gift incentives for coming. And then the parents can come because, you know what, it's on a Saturday. I don't have to go to work first on Saturday. That's Monday through Friday. I've got a little free time. My children can learn some literacy skills in the corner while I'm learning what's going on at the schools. So the local schools need to be a little bit more creative in trying to meet parents maybe halfway to give them that momentum. And then we have to think about it, too. Some parents have been denigrated and hurt by the public school sector, because I had an incident that happened well over 15 years ago, that there was a young lady who had some substance abuse problems, and she went into relapse again, and she started going back into the same behavior. Her children were taken from her by protective services. They came to the school and got her children. She ended up having to go through my training classes, and then after she went through my training classes, she had to do some community service. It took about a year and a half for her to get her children back. Do you not know that the moment that she got her children back, she moved out of town. Why? Because she believed that the school tried to set her up for failure and to hurt her as a parent. And you know what? Long years after that, I finally ran into her at one of the shopping malls right here in the state of Michigan. And she told me, she said, you know what, I just don't even want my children in school, period. I don't trust schools. I don't trust people that work in schools. She says, I trust you because I know who you are. You would never do that to me. She said, but far as I'm concerned, I will never, ever let my children go to another public school. I'll just do like I'm doing, homeschooling them. So we have to look at the experience level. Have there been negative experiences? And we need to change the way that we treat people when they walk into our building. You know what? We're only as great as the commodities, the priceless commodities, the children that come into our building. I look at parents as a investment processor. Our children are the investment that we're all supposed to be ascribing for. So let's make this environment, you know, calm, cool, collected, welcoming, and nurturing so that when parents may be curious about getting involved, offer them opportunities, show them that you're a part of us. There's no big eyes and little youths. There's no longer this big demagoguery of the cement wall saying, look at who I am and what you're not. We're all in this together.
Wow. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. So you talked about the welfare system, substance abuse, and the stabilizing residency. What are some of the resources that these parents can use when they're in situations like this?
Well, the first thing that we're very fortunate, I have a full-service parent center, parent resource center at our school. And basically what I do is I give, you know, parents when they're enrolling their students in, even in the first of the year when we do the back-to-school orientation, I give them my personal number and I give them the school number. And we list all of the resources that we do. We do emergency food baskets. We do emergency clothing. If there's an issue with placement and residency, I assist them to get housing. You know, with the utility payments, and some of them have said, you know what, Abby, my lights just got cut off. You know, my child, you know, is on breathing treatments. I can't use electricity. Then I generally make the connection to the utility company and say, now, hey, come on here. And the minute they know it's me, they suddenly want to talk and negotiate something. So we're that go-between so that when parents get in trouble, they know that they can come to the school and get those resources. And sometimes when the issue is a little bit more external and it may go into the area of law enforcement, we have a service that's plugged in with us and have been with us 17 years called Legal Aid Defenders Association. And they're able to help with getting PPOs, like say, for instance, one of our parents has separated from her abusive spouse. She didn't want to leave the area. She said she felt it was her privilege and her right to remain in her place even after getting away from him. He was following her as she was taking the kids to school. Well, because we have an on-site attorney, she was able to process her a personal order of protection right then and there, saying if this man is seen anywhere in the perimeter where you are, he will be arrested. So we have legal services that are there. We have on-site tutorial, even after school programs. So we just house in all schools. If they're going to survive and remain open and operative and functioning at a full capacity, we'll have to translate from just being mere educational establishments to being globalized community schools of excellence. You've got to house the community in the school so that parents will have accessibility. Because when you tell parents to go halfway across town, what if that parent has more than one child? What if she has a small child? What if she doesn't have transportation? It is the school's responsibility to nurture the community, nurture the families, and to condense these services on site. So that's what we do, and it works. Our model is called the turnaround school model, and it works. And if a school wants to achieve and to maximize their optimism and maximize their proficiency, they're going to have to adopt to that model of the MARIFA because it works.
So if I'm a parent listening to the show now and I'm in Michigan and I was like, wow, man, I really need all of this good stuff, right? So how does one get in contact with you? How do they get this good resource?
Okay. First, they can always email me at abby.phelps@detroitk12.com. abby.phelps@detroitk12.org. Again, that's abby.phelps@detroitk12.org. And they can also call me in my office. I'm in my office from 7:30 to 4:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time at 313-852-8072. And also, they can reach me, and I have a 24-hour cell number. I never limit the accessibility to that because if it's urgent cases, I'm available. 313-870-7102.
Outstanding. Again, it is abby.phelps, A-B-B-Y, dot Phelps, P-H-E-L-P-S, at DetroitK12.org. And that's from 7:30 to 4:30, and your office number is 313-852-8072.
Yes.
And your 24-hour cell number is 313-870-7102.
Capiche.
All right. Outstanding. So now, let's say there are other states in around the country listening to the show, which they are. We have millions of listeners out there, and they want to adopt this model. Now, what are some of the things that you can do or that this institution can do to adopt this turnaround school model?
Okay, the first thing that we always advise, let's start off early on before the next school year begins. I always say that May is a great month for planning for the upcoming school year because here you're going to see the exodus of the school year probably at the end of the month or the middle part of the next month. Start off with an evaluation or an assessment. Get to know the people that are in the community and the level in which parents are in at the local school, because you do need that local school, parent organization of official record, such as PTA, Parent Teacher Association. Do an assessment. And, you know, you may want to send this little assessment home. Make it no longer than 5 questions. Ask them what is it that they would like to see at the local school. What is their opinion of the school environment? What do they think needs to change? Thirdly, you may ask them, does their child have any attendance issues that needs to be, supported? What can the school do to support or help improve your child's attendance? That child may have a physical ailment and that parent may not be able to get the treatments to them, so we're able to identify that. Then ask them what types of programs would they like to see at the local school. And then the fifth question can be, how would you like to get involved with the school? And they might say, I want to be a PTA officer, or I want to come in once a week and read a story to the children. I want to work in the disciplinary room. And then they can tell you. And then confidentially, so they don't have to put a name on it. Or even if you want to get a little more exclusive, you can ask them for a name and a phone number. And then, you know, this is a way of tracking, identifying what people are looking for. This is why a lot of schools don't succeed. They're not in touch with the dichotomy of the populations that are out there. They are not even consistent to know what their needs are. And also, too, you may want to put a bonus question and find out if that person bilingual or maybe language limited or may need some, you know, some tutorial as far as their English is concerned, because we have a lot of districts that have a lot of Hmong students. They have a lot of Arabic students. They have a lot of Hispanic students and a lot of Creole students and things like that, and we need to find that out if we need translatory services at our school. So that's the first thing that we do to set the pace. And I advise that, you know, you go out into the community, do your welcome wagon. This is something that's very effective. You distribute these little small evaluations, knock on the doors. Like the Avon lady used to knock on the door. Hey, knock on the door. You know, you're definitely trying to buy them into the educational system. Maybe offer them a nice little incentive, whether it's nothing but a chocolate bar, and saying, because you're a sweetheart, here's a chocolate heart, or something like that. To break down the ice, because people need to know that you care and that you know that you're there for them, that you're not putting up this wall, this petition, that's saying, I'm better than you, I don't need you. No, we both need each other. So you break the ice like that. The second thing I say is that at the beginning of the school year, have a parent orientation breakfast where you invite the parents to come into the school to meet the staff, greet the staff, find out what the school policies are early on. So if they have questions or concerns, and they may say, well, you know what, I did the evaluation, my child is still having the problem. They can get their problems addressed early on as a way of identifying those problematic areas. Then you make sure that you structure your parent and teacher organization at the beginning of the year. You know, most of the elections are done by voluntary officers. They don't even have elections a lot of times. Just people who want to volunteer say, I want to be the president. I want to come in. I want to be a help. I want to be a change agent. Let them come in and offer their suggestions, offer them the professional development training along with the staff so that they know what their roles and responsibilities are. Sponsor events that bring children and their parents together. You know, sometimes it's maybe just a family fun night where they just play board games, have pizza, you know, drink soda, and just talk to each other. This is another way of creating that loving, that nurturing learning environment, you know. And so there's a lot of things that you can do, but the mainstay is creating that assessment to get in touch with the people and so that you'll know where the areas of needs are.
So let's look at this from a parent's perspective. Let's say that, you know, I'm listening to the show, and these are all wonderful, great things. But my school system don't provide any of these things, and I want to get engaged. So as a parent, what should I do?
Okay, this is what I suggest to parents. Okay, once again, parents, you know, sometimes you may not feel comfortable inside the school. You know, most of us shop in the supermarkets that are in our area. We see our neighbors, we see our friends, the people we may see at the religious establishment we attend. Have your little short span conversations in your public area. And, you know, and share and network that information, exchange phone numbers. And then one person needs to brave up to the plate. The person that really feels intuitive about making parental involvement work needs to go to that local school because by law and by proxy, if you're getting Title I money under Public Law 103.382, which was formerly 100.297 Title I legislation, parental involvement is Section 1118 that constitutes that any school receiving federal funds labeled as Title I must spend at least 1% of that entire Title I budget on parent involvement-related activities, whether it's refreshments, parent incentives, conference registrations. It has to be spent on parents. If you do not have parental involvement or an official body of parent organization in that school, you will lose your Title I funding. So, yes, there's an open-door policy. There's nothing private about public record, and this is public record. That person needs to go to the school and ask to speak with the administrator, the principal of the school, and have a short-span conversation. Prepare those questions. Can I see the Title I budget? Yes, by law and proxy, any parent can request that, and by law, that administrator is supposed to have it in a public area where it's easily accessible. If not, they could run across a lot of correctional action if they don't. Then that parent can ask, you know, that I want to start a parent group. We don't have one. When can I have a location and a time where I can have a parent meeting? Because we need to become involved with the local school and kind of change over some things that may have been hanging or waiting in the wings for a while. 75% of the administrators are going to welcome you coming into the school, but it's all about attitude. Don't come in there like you own and stuff. You're going to be running somebody. No, you come with a compliant, you know what I'm saying? You know, mm-hmm. Like some folks, you'll get a little stir. Yeah, you know what them trash cans be for? That lunchroom be dirty. I'm going to go in and tell her off. Yeah, and she'll send you right out that door with the security. So you want to be compliant. You want to be decent. You want to be professional. Dress yourself up a little bit. Present yourself correctly. You know, have a positive attitude. Smile and just simply say to the administrator, we need to start a parent organization. We don't have one. Can we get your support? Can we get your approval? And then, yes, you can ask to see a copy of that budget because by law and by proxy, 1% of the entire budget must be utilized for parent-related activities. So once you get those things in structure, you get your meeting place, you have your designation of when those meeting times will be, this is when you can do your connection piece. You send out your bulletins. We have what's called the Blackboard announcement system. It's connected to every parent within our school. It will call you personally and invite you to the meeting. And what better way to have the children to turn around and create a flyer for their parents? Let me tell you, at our open house, this was so funny, Mr. Cook. What's your name, Sheila? And we had the children to actually create a flyer for their parents to come to the open house. We had over 500 parents that came to our school.
Wow.
You hear me? Yes, because the children had ownership, and the children were saying, please, Mama, I need you to come. Please, Mama, your support is important. They know those kids up to do that.
Right, right.
They know we did it, but because it was their children, they came because they wanted the children to be proud. And then give them a performance at the first meeting. Make it a grand meeting. Have that wonderful breakfast. Again, your Title I funds, because you have a policy plan of action in place, you can actually have food catered into your event. Offer some small gift incentives for parents coming. Have a student to perform, you know, because parents love to see their children perform. That just gets them over the hump and the bump, and it just changes the environment. So that's a lot, but just get that foot in that door, and the rest, we'll play it by ear, and it'll sound like a sweet melody.
You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. I'm your host, Patrick Cook, and today our very special guest is the Esquire Abby Phelps. Abby is a nationally respected empowerment educational orator and training specialist that has presented at over 380 public venues in Michigan and throughout the country for over 20 years, and she is a relationship counselor. She created and founded the Parent University Initiative, Reviving the Village Initiative, the Season for Change School Fitness Program, Parents Taking the Lead Collaboration, and the list goes on. So, Abby, let me ask you this. What's next for you?
Yeah. You know something, I'm looking at actually the National Prayer Day as being the next venue that I'm working on, because it's so essential, and this is just a lovely time of commemoration and appreciation that we're all allowed in our public sector venues to be able to just focus on the universal creator that made us, not about promoting religion or a denomination. It's just about opening up and sitting in that positive energy. So I'm really looking forward to that. That's my next venue. And another thing that I'm looking to do, a little theatrical performing.
What?
And I'm getting it. Yes, that's coming on the list. And definitely, I'm going to star you in the production.
So talk a little bit about that.
Yes, you know something? It's been on my heart and my mind for quite a while to do a little radio theater.
Okay.
And, you know, because it's so creative. Yes, I used to listen to the Canadian network, CKLW, when they have, you know, 11 o'clock, they have the radio theater. And
mm-hmm.
It's just so creative and so aspiring. I said, you know, this will really, really promote a new faith in entertainment to have
mm-hmm.
radio theater. And so I've been working on a couple of skits, and things are looking pretty good. I'm looking within the next year to actually put the production on the market. And definitely I want you there. Because you can
awesome.
Be the new face, Howard Cosell and Geraldo Rivera, all wrapped up into one.
Awesome.
Geraldo Cosell.
Once again, tell our listening audience how to get in contact with you.
Yes. Again, you can simply go to abby.phelps@detroitk12.org. Or else you can call me in the office 7:30 to 4:30 p.m. Monday through Friday at 313-852-8072 or 24 hours accessibility on the sale 313-870-7102. Oh, and another thing. Oh, definitely, because we're gearing up for a decision 2012.
Okay. All right.
Yes, whose side are you on? Early on. You know I'm going to come back to you again. Whose side are you pulling on?
Well, you know, I'm watching right now, so I'm not revealing anything yet. I'm just going to see how it plays out. But I'm always leaning to links, as they say in Germany.
To links. Okay. Well, you know something. Certainly you're going to have me on over and over again. I just got to say something out of entertainment. I'm just doing a little satire. Guys out there in listening audience, don't take it personal. I said, you know what? If Ron Paul and Mitt Romney and Sarah Palin are the best that the other side has, boy, they are in trouble.
I know that's right.
But rumor has it that Newt Gingrich did an awesome presentation, and that they're actually saying, it's waiting in the wings, as time goes on, you and I will have some conversation, that
all
he
right.
may be the forerunner for the right-wing extremist. Uh-oh.
Okay.
Wow.
Okay. So we're closing down here on our last 90 seconds of the show. Any final comments?
Oh, it's been a wonderful, wonderful time. I look forward to coming back to you again real soon, and especially getting close to that decision 2012.
Mm. All right.
Wonderful show. I love it. I love you. I love your co-host, and just thank you so much, and I'm looking forward to coming back to you real soon.
Awesome. thanks to all the listeners out there for tuning in. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. I'm your host, Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas, as I do every Sunday at 4 p.m. Central Time, 5 o'clock Eastern. We are the number one resource for small business and nonprofits. Don't forget to bookmark this site and visit my blog at TaylorMadeTalkRadio.blogspot.com. That's TaylorMadeTalkRadio.blogspot.com. Until next time, remember it is written, my people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge. So stay engaged, stay informed, and stay plugged in to Current Events with Patrick Cook. You're listening to the sounds of Joyce Spencer, Sweet Dreams. Take us away, Joyce.